Campaign 76. I'm Sharon Lovejoy reporting on the CBS radio network from our convention headquarters in Kansas City. Everybody knows that President Ford and Ronald Reagan are fighting it out for the Republican nomination. But there's another politician around who says he's available. His face is lined, his eyes peer out from beneath a hood of wrinkles. His hair, all but gone now, has been replaced by a stiff, ill-fitting toupee. And when he says he's running for the Republican presidential nomination, reporters smile and ask if he's a serious candidate. The answer is always yes. His name is Harold Stassen. In the past 28 years, he's run for the Republican nomination 4 times. Each time, he's been defeated. But that hasn't stopped the one-time governor of Minnesota. Stassen originally had planned to stay out of this race, but in June, he changed his mind at the request, he says, of several uncommitted delegates. Most Americans may not be aware of his candidacy, but Republican delegates certainly have been informed.
We have contacted all the delegates by writing and many by phone. There are still remaining about 200 uncommitted, and our target is to have 100 of those uncommitted cast ballots for us on the first ballot. We do not have a hard and fast count as of today because it's moving every day, and likewise, we're not asking for commitments. We're only extending invitations.
A record of 4 losses has not curbed Stassen's enthusiasm in the least. He arrived at the convention a week early, armed with suggestions for the party platform. He wasn't given time to speak before the entire platform committee, but undaunted, he appeared at a subcommittee meeting and shocked some delegates with at least one of his proposals, namely that the Republican Party should officially tell Richard Nixon that all is forgiven.
I have felt that the Republican Party makes a mistake to ignore his years, and that is why I advocated to the platform committee that we should have a plank somewhat in these words. We hold that the perspective of history will show that much that was good and constructive was accomplished during President Nixon's administration, that his resignation was ample punishment for any wrongdoing on his part, and that President Ford was fully justified and was wise and sincere in his pardon.
In all the years that Stassen has run for the presidency, he has never once challenged a Republican incumbent. And he wouldn't be in the race now, he says, if President Ford had been able to show more strength during the primaries and in the months before the convention. With tongue in cheek, Stassen says that if he doesn't win the nomination this year either, he'll do as he's always done, support the party's choice.
I have never been critical of either President Ford or Governor Reagan. I do not intend to be now. I do not intend to express any preference between them and just remain in the position or in that eventuality that I could unite the Republican Party and then bring in large numbers of the independents, the Democrats, and the working people to lead to a majority victory in November.
Stassen tells anyone who will listen that he could lead the Republican Party to victory in November, but as in times past, hardly anyone seems to be listening. Campaign 76. I'm Sharon Lovejoy, CBS News. Campaign 76. I'm Sharon Lovejoy, CBS News, reporting on the CBS radio network from our convention headquarters in Kansas City. There are a number of touchy issues under discussion at the Republican Platform Committee meetings this week. Détente, the Panama Canal, abortion. One that could end up in a floor fight when the convention officially gets underway is the Equal Rights Amendment. Conservative backers of Ronald Reagan are against the amendment and would like to see a hardline platform plank that ignores the issue altogether. It appears the conservatives may be winning that battle. The first draft of the Republican Party platform has no mention of the ERA at all. But there is a group at the convention dedicated to persuading Republicans to support the ERA. It's called the Republican Women's Task Force, led by Chairwoman Pat Goldman.
As far as I'm concerned, support for the ERA is a priority issue, not only for the women, but for the Republican Party. To back down on ERA now would be a gesture of bad faith to the women in the Republican Party who have worked so hard, and the women in this country who are working for that. We're working on that now. That vote will come up this afternoon in the full platform committee, and we are confident that we will be successful on that issue.
Some members of the task force say that it seems odd the Republican Party is divided on the amendment. After all, they say, support of equal rights for women has been a tradition in the GOP. A member of the task force, Betsy Griffin.
It is a historic commitment of this party. In the Republican Congress that passed the suffrage amendment, the Republican Congress which introduced the Equal Rights Amendment, a Republican president that has endorsed it every time it's been up. It is the historic commitment of this party not only to women's rights, but to minority rights, which means that we must keep that commitment and not repudiate it. I don't think the party will.
There has been a subcommittee tug of war over the ERA all week long. At platform discussions on Monday, opponents came armed with signs urging the party to oppose the ERA question, and they've been highly visible all week. Tuesday, the platform committee in its entirety heard testimony on the ERA, both pro and con. And anti-ERA forces, most of them Reagan conservatives, gave a standing ovation to the country's leading opponent of the amendment, Phyllis Schlafly. Wednesday, a victory for the conservatives. The Subcommittee on Human Rights voted to drop from the first platform draft any mention of the ERA. But the matter has not been settled. A member of the Women's Task Force, Betsy Griffin, says that nothing less than the endorsement of the ERA is acceptable to them.
If it's rejected in the platform committee, it's not going to end there. There will be a floor fight. And if we don't win the floor fight, there will be a fight throughout the entire campaign. Whom there are many in this country who will not support a Republican candidate who does not espouse the Equal Rights Amendment. And I'm not sure you would find both candidates, whichever of the two, I'm not sure that one of them would ever run on that platform plank. Surely the president has committed himself again and again to the Equal Rights Amendment, and he may have to disassociate himself from a platform that contains a repudiation of it.
Today, the ERA goes before the platform committee for a vote. Campaign 76. I'm Sharon Lovejoy, CBS News, Kansas City.
Campaign 76. I'm Christopher Glenn, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The finish line is in sight in the long, hard race between Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan for the Republican presidential nomination. But even at this point, just a few days before the decisive moment, neither man can make a solid prediction of victory. Not that it isn't being tried, far from it. Just yesterday, Reagan's top strategist, John Sears, said it again. They have more than the 1,130 votes needed for nomination.
As I've always said, on Wednesday night, the nomination ballot, if that's what you're interested in, we'll have at least 1,140 delegates voting for Ronald Reagan.
Just this morning, President Ford's chief delegate hunter, James Baker, claimed their latest count gives Mr. Ford 1,135 votes, Reagan only 1,031, with 93 delegates coming to Kansas City uncommitted. And Baker has high hopes for big gains among them.
At least half of those uncommitted, those 60 uncommitted delegates taking Mississippi out of there, would be likely to get.
Mississippi is a unique situation. 30 technically uncommitted delegates and much speculation about whether the delegation will abandon its unit vote and split between the two contenders. The Reagan camp has been claiming for weeks that it has many secret or hidden or Trojan horse delegates who will be coming out into the open sooner or later. And now, as time grows short, the Ford forces and James Baker are starting to talk the same way.
We do have some private assurances that uncommitted delegates will commit to us when they get to Kansas City, and we will have an announcement with respect to that before the balloting begins. I'm not going to get into the numbers on those until we have our announcement.
Baker claims his present assessment of the president's strength is quite firm.
I've told you all along that we put delegates in our column when they're either bound for the president or where they've made some form of public statement. Now, I don't think we've violated that principle.
But that causes outrage in Reagan's man, John Sears, who doesn't go along with news media accounts, most of which show Reagan with well under 1,100 votes.
We would dispute any count that would give us anything down in the less in the 1,000s at all. As for Mr. Ford's counts, as I have always said, and I think you'll find this to be true next week when we actually do some balloting on some things, Mr. Ford's count is a very soft count.
And Sears explains his assessment of the president's strength as only reasonable politically.
That is a unique situation here that is caused by the fact that we are running against an incumbent president. And politically speaking, there are a number of people that just can't afford politically to be publicly identified with going against him until the time comes near when they have to.
So the question is, as usual, who do you trust? With state delegations streaming into town this weekend, teams of workers, wooers actually, from both camps will be fanning out, trying ever so gently or not so gently to persuade, to convince, to cajole, to plead for commitments from the uncommitted. And it'll probably be that next Wednesday night, when the first state answers the roll to cast the first votes of the first ballot, each side will still be biting its nails, still uncertain of the outcome. Campaign 76. In Kansas City, I'm Christopher Glenn, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Betty Ann Bowser reporting on the CBS Radio Network from our convention headquarters in Kansas City. There is probably no place in American politics where there are more managers than at a national party convention. There are campaign managers who manage the candidates, floor managers who manage the delegates for the candidates' campaign managers. But there's also somebody you don't hear much about who manages all the managers, the convention manager. His name is Odie Fish. He's a seasoned Republican Party worker, a veteran of more conventions than he'd like to remember. And because his party has a hotly contested race for the presidential nomination, Odie Fish has problems. It's up to him to see who gets onto the convention floor and who doesn't, where dignitaries sit, how long the politicians get to talk, and when. Right now, Fish is trying to keep everybody in the Ford and Reagan campaigns happy.
I'm talking about the nearness of the candidate trailers to the entrance, so it's the same number of steps. I'm talking about parking spaces. I'm talking about the Sky Suites, the VIP box for each one of them. It's the same exact same number of square feet with the exact same angle to the podium. And I could go on with 100 items of that nature.
Fish is also the man who figures out the convention schedule, then tries to keep the politicians to it. He's worried about that part. Already a number of fights are developing over the Equal Rights Amendment, maybe over abortion. Fish says floor fights over issues are okay with him, but the last thing he needs is to have the stars of the political show making their acceptance speeches at 3 o'clock in the morning. Then there are the delegates. He didn't think the Democrats behaved very well on television last month, talking during the prayers and all. He wants his Republican delegates to show some manners.
I probably will rue the day I say this. I thought they did not behave as well as you'd like them to behave. But I guess that's kind of traditional, and we're doing everything we can to urge our delegates to behave a little better. We're not prohibiting people from bringing newspapers into the hall, but we are not permitting the sale of newspapers before a session.
Why?
Well, because they take them into the session and they read the newspaper instead of listening to an address that they don't particularly like to hear, and that's what's picked up on the media.
Fish says his biggest nightmare is security, but other than that...
And I guess the biggest scare I've got at the moment is... trying to keep our sessions on schedule, because if there are repeated roll calls on rules, credentials, or platform, the five sessions that we have could be in trouble.
Fish answered a lot of questions this week, but he said the one we asked him really made him stop and put on his thinking cap. It was, what is a convention manager really?
I guess a mother confessor. I've thought about having no tattooed on my bald head, so that I made the observation that I've said no so often in the last 6 months that I sometimes feel like a virgin.
When the gavel goes down and the television lights come on next week, somewhere behind the podium, sitting at a desk with a phone in each ear, far from all the hoopla, you will probably find Odie Fish telling somebody else the answer is no. Now this message.
The Republican National Convention begins Monday, August 16th, with all the hoopla and harangues that earmark these quadrennial events. CBS News' George Herman and Neil Strausser will co-anchor live selective coverage of the convention, and Dallas Townsend brings you analysis. Listen for CBS News convention coverage twice each hour, with major developments broadcast live in full. The Republican National Convention beginning Monday, August 16th, on the CBS Radio Network.
Campaign 76. From Kansas City, I'm Betty Ann Bowser, CBS News.
Campaign 76, sponsored in part by the brewers of Budweiser Beer. I'm George Herman, reporting on the CBS Radio Network from our convention headquarters in Kansas City. And with me, my colleague, CBS News White House correspondent Bob Pierpoint. Bob, I guess the first question anybody would ask a White House correspondent at this point is, how did it go for the president?
Obviously, anyone who is around the White House on the staff would say it went beautifully. It went just according to their schedule. They won the victory that they came here to win, and they, in fact, won it about the way they said they would. Now, that's the superficial view, and I suppose that if one were willing to stop right there, it would all sound just great. But, in fact, there are some other things that are impinge on this. For one thing, Mr. Ford definitely suffered a setback on the platform committee problem of foreign affairs, the so-called morality clause, or morality section that was introduced by the Reagan people was not what Mr. Ford and his people wanted in the platform, and it's there nevertheless. They took it because they wanted to avoid a fight. That is going to hurt their defense of their own foreign policy in the coming battle.
Yes, but do you think that Jimmy Carter will attack from the same direction as the Republican conservatives, saying that he was too soft on Panama, too soft on detente, and so forth?
No, on the contrary. I think that what Jimmy Carter will do is say that Mr. Ford had a policy which he had to abandon under the pressure of the conservatives in the Republican Party, and he has now moved to the right, and I think that Jimmy Carter will attack from the other side.
I noticed some of the reports say the president, in keeping tally on the night in which he was nominated, had a score which was, 10 or 11 votes under what he actually got. Was he just being cautious?
Yes, I think they were being a little deliberately cautious. I think they had it pretty well cased, but they were not quite sure about some of those uncommitted votes. They were soft on those, and I think that's why he played it on the cautious side. George, let me point out one other thing that I think may become a bit of a problem for the president. And that is that he has found as his running mate a man who is about as conservative as he is. And that was probably forced on him by the Reagan wing of the party, not necessarily the man. But moving to the conservative side of the party was probably a result of the Reagan effort. And in Senator Dole, who is very conservative philosophically, he has now a running mate who is going to appeal to a limited a number of people in the political spectrum, and I think in the long run that may hurt also.
Thanks very much. This has been Campaign 76, sponsored in part by the Brewers of Budweiser Beer. My colleague is Robert Pierpoint. I'm George Herman, CBS News. Campaign 76, I'm George Herman, reporting on the CBS radio network from our convention headquarters in Kansas City. I'll be talking with White House correspondent Robert Pierpoint after this. Bob, we're facing now an election campaign with both teams known, Carter Mondale versus Ford Dole. What does Bob Dole add to the Ford ticket?
Probably he adds a campaign pizzazz, George. He is a good campaigner, a good speaker. He has a wit, a sense of humor, and a sharp tongue. There is some talk among the Ford supporters here and the White House aides that Bob Dole will be able to get under Jimmy Carter's skin very quickly and make Jimmy Carter wince and make some public errors.
You may remember in the early days when Dole appointed himself President Nixon's chief defender in the Senate, he made some of us wince on occasion.
That's right. He does have, though, a sharp sense of humor, and it's a political sense of humor, and he can needle his opponents quite well, and I think that's one thing he will add to the campaign.
Another thing may be, I notice he testified before the Resolutions or Platform Committee very strongly for a plank which would forbid presidents to impose any kind of formal or informal embargo on farm products. That's one of the sore subjects with farmers and voters in this central part of the country, President Ford's embargo on exports of wheat to the Soviet Union.
There's no doubt that Senator Dole is well-liked by the farmers, and Gerald Ford has not been so well-liked because of that embargo he placed on exports to the Soviet Union last year. And while farmers normally vote Republican anyway, they've been looking a little skeptically at Mr. Ford lately, so he will certainly help in that area as well. Former Governor John Connally talked about Senator Dole and how much he liked him and how much he thought he was going to go over in the state of Texas and in other southern areas. So that I think in that sense, probably he has a little more widespread appeal and perhaps even in the West than might be expected of most Midwesterners.
That's possibly true, but I don't think any of the Republicans here are betting that he will take any of the southern states away from Jimmy Carter.
It won't be easy, George.
It won't be. This is Campaign 76. I'm George Herman, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Hal Walker, reporting on the CBS radio network. A familiar name in the restaurant business and in southern politics is making a run for the presidency. Former Georgia Governor Lester Maddox says he'll seek the nomination of the American Independent Party. Lester Maddox doesn't pass out pick handles anymore to remind people of the time he chased blacks away from his Pickwick restaurant in Atlanta, but the one-time Georgia governor's political philosophy remains about the same as it was then. He now accuses Alabama Governor George Wallace of having gone over to the side of the pointy-headed liberals and declared that it was up to him, Maddox, to pick up the fallen standard of the conservatives.
My decision was made recognizing that it would be difficult, It would be a trying thing, but looking at the platform of the Democratic and Republican parties, looking at the candidates, looking at their records, looking at the problems we're confronted with in America, I felt that I had no choice if I wanted to continue to strive to be a good citizen.
Maddox said Ford and Carter are tools of the ultra-liberals whose platforms cause him to fear for the future of America.
The platform of Lester Maddox would be a platform to campaign by and a platform to live by. All the difference in the world is much different between night and day. And I would pledge the most open, honest, efficient, and representative government that the nation's capital has known in 20th century America.
His platform would call for a veto of guaranteed annual wage legislation, federal child care proposals, and gun control. He said he would seek a constitutional amendment against liberalized abortions and what he called forced busing. In foreign affairs, his first act as president would involve the current Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger.
I really believe that Kissinger is doing the will of Russia, not the will of the United States of America. If I were president, he would last 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, ever how long it would take to sign the papers or call him in or make the telephone call to dispose of him as secretary.
Domestically, Maddox said he would return the national speed limit to 70. Campaign 76, I'm Hal Walker, CBS News.
Campaign 76, I'm Robert Pierpoint on the CBS Radio Network. President Ford wants to debate Jimmy Carter as soon as possible. President Ford called reporters to his Vail vacation home today to say that he wants to challenge his opponent Jimmy Carter to a series of debates.
I feel very strongly that the first debate should come a day or two after Labor Day. And I suggest perhaps September 8th, September 9th, September 10th. I think there should be four debates, and each debate should involve no less than 90 minutes on each occasion. The subject matters, of course, are those issues that the American people want to know, where my opponent stands and where I stand. They have a right to know. I feel, for example, the first debate ought to involve national defense. The other three issues would be domestic policy, foreign policy, economic policy.
Mr. Ford and his aides obviously are trying to project an image of a tough, confident leader who is taking the offensive against a weak challenger. They want to start earlier than Carter had contemplated because they believe President Ford is more ready, that he's already familiar with the subject matter, and that this will show up Carter as weak on the issues. They want the first debate to concern matters of national defense because they feel that Carter is most vulnerable in this area, and it will get Mr. Ford off to a strong start. The president did not say today just what format he prefers, who will do the questioning, or whether he wants a one-on-one confrontation with only a moderator. Mr. Ford said his representative would be designated later this week to meet with Carter's to negotiate the details. Some of this feigned truculence on the part of the president seems unnecessary. Carter has indicated he's perfectly willing to accept just about any format. After all, an incumbent normally does not debate, so in one sense, Carter already has what he wants, a platform from which to force President Ford to defend his policies. What really counts now is not who comes out of his corner first and fastest, but who the voters perceive as the winner. Campaign 76, I'm Robert Pierpoint, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Bruce Hall, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Expecting a resurgence of Republican popularity following the GOP convention, Jimmy Carter is trying to recapture the spotlight. Historically, August is always a bad month for the Democratic presidential candidates, and Jimmy Carter expects the Republicans to close the gap somewhat in the opinion polls. But he is making an all-out attempt to prevent the normal August slippage from continuing into September. He has disregarded the traditional Democratic method of not starting a campaign until Labor Day. Carter and his entire family are campaigning full-time, using a carefully planned schedule that virtually guarantees maximum exposure in the media and large crowds. With a chuckle, Carter publicly insists he is obeying the Democratic tradition of not starting until Labor Day. He says he just happened to walk through a market in Los Angeles greeting voters in Spanish. Just happened to accompany Tom Bradley and Andy Young to what? Just happened to accompany Party Chairman Bob Strauss to fundraising receptions in San Francisco. Just happened to be in Seattle to talk to the American Legion Convention. and to greet workers at a plant shift change at 6 a.m. and just happened to be in Iowa in time that he could blast the Ford administration farm policies at the state fair. But to everyone who was along on the trip, it was a grueling three-day multi-state campaign tour, similar to those shortly before an election. Meanwhile, the other members of the Carter family are appearing in Florida, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. In a little more than 3 days, some members of the Carter family visited almost every area in the country where the Democratic nominee expects a tough fight or where he fared poorly in the primaries. And all of this coming while President Ford is planning his campaign in a vacation retreat in Vail, Colorado. Carter felt President Ford beat him to the punch in challenging him to a debate in his acceptance speech, just hours before Carter planned to issue his own challenge. Carter is determined not to let that happen again. That is the reason the entire family is out on the election trail before the opening of the official campaign. Carter has vowed to himself to get the upper hand immediately and to keep President Ford on the defensive as much as possible from now to Election Day. Campaign 76. I'm Bruce Hall, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Eric Engberg reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The Dole campaign, its course up to now, can be plotted by following Jimmy Carter. Wherever Carter went, Dole popped up 24 hours later. Robert Dole, President Ford's running mate, making his first campaign swing, looked something like the private detective in the movies who commandeers a taxi and orders, "Follow that car." In Dole's case, that car is the Carter campaign. Carter spoke to American Legionnaires in Seattle. Dole spoke to Legionnaires in Seattle. Carter spoke to farmers in Iowa. Dole did likewise. Dole kept telling newsmen his stalking routine was mere coincidence, but not so much a coincidence that his speeches weren't carefully tailored to rebuke Carter for what he had said the day before. Starting well behind in the polls, the Republicans have decided to go on the attack early and aggressively. It used to be there was a campaign lull between the conventions and Labor Day. No longer. Both parties have their troops in the field, and the banners and the campaign rhetoric are flying as though it were late October. Dole has already assumed the role of the Republicans' chief Carter stinger, handling the attacks, the viewing with alarm, the firing up of partisan audiences. That would leave President Ford free for more presidential activities so the voters would perceive him as somewhat above the battle. Dole has taken quickly and naturally to his job, taking Carter to task for his stand on pardons for draft resistors, questioning his credentials as a friend of the farmer. Dole brings to this job a hard-nosed partisanship, which is not unusual for a politician, but also a quick sense of humor, which is. He noted the other day, for example, that the controversial right-to-work provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act would be a campaign issue, then added, "Carter thinks 14B is a shoe size." Carter says he will refuse to respond to Dole's attacks and will not lose his temper. Dole, looking innocent about it all, but still placing his tongue in cheek, says he's not following Carter at all, just showing up at some of the same places. By the end of the campaign, Dole says, he and the Republican ticket expect to be arriving in places ahead of Carter. Campaign 76, with the Dole campaign in Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Eric Engberg, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Sam Shulin, reporting from Syracuse, New York, on the CBS Radio Network. Mondale calls Ford and Dole the most anti-city tickets to seek election since 1964.
Seldom have the American people had such a clear choice between two tickets and the platforms they're running on. And for city dwellers, the choice is remarkably clear.
Senator Walter Mondale, Democratic vice presidential nominee, speaking to a group of Syracuse Democrats. Mondale says it's very clear the Republicans have turned their backs on the cities and cites his opponent's record. He gives as examples the president's proposal to cut back federal subsidies to mass transit, Ford's opposition of federal funds for emergency housing assistance for cities.
Now, you would think with a record like that, the president would have sought out a running mate who at least provided some evidence of offsetting concern for the lives in the cities of our great cities of America.
Dole's record, Mondale says, is worse. Dole's vote against the Energy Policy and Conservation Act.
If Ford had gotten away with his proposal to immediately deregulate oil, it would have cost each family in Syracuse $500 more to live this year than it does now. And how many families could afford that? It would have caused inflation to soar, and it would have increased unemployment. Mr. Dole voted for that policy.
Mondale says the anti-city record of Dole's goes on.
He voted against the Housing Act of 61 and 64. He voted against the creation of the Housing and Urban Development Department. He voted against the Metropolitan Development Act and against funds for urban renewal in 69 and 70. He voted to delete subsidies for mass transit and operating subsidies as well.
In contrast, Mondale says the Democratic ticket is pro-city.
We want people who live in cities to have a decent life, decent housing, a job, and we want cities to be livable, and we want people who live in cities to be proud of them and want to continue to live there. That couldn't be a more fundamental difference between the two tickets.
Campaign 76. I'm Sam Chulin, CBS News, Syracuse.
Campaign 76. I'm Douglas Edwards, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Republican Party officials are striving to close ranks quickly between the Reagan and Ford forces. And now President Ford and his strategists are busily searching for a winning Republican formula to convince skeptics that the formula will indeed work. Ford strategists are faced with answering up to three questions. First, where to focus the attacks. Second, which issues will work in those places. And third, just what kind of a personal style should Mr. Ford take? In picking Senator Robert Dole of Kansas for his running mate, the president selected a man whose conservatism nearly matches his own. He went along with party unity instead of ideological balance. The Ford strategy that seems to be emerging is this: build a power base in the Rocky Mountain states and in the Southwest. Erode some of Jimmy Carter's strength in the border states. Work to carry two or three of the more conservative states in the Great Lakes region. Fight to the wire in California, Florida, and Texas. And then, with luck, get a slim electoral majority. It's not exactly a strategy you can call a Sunbelt formula, but more a kind of Western strategy, with the Midwest serving as a sort of pivotal region without which a majority would not be possible. The Ford people fully realize that this approach is the one that might just get around the difficulties of trying to carry the Deep South against the now famous peanut farmer of Plains, Georgia. In the absence of a Southern strategy, many Northeastern liberal Republicans have called for an opposite approach, one that returns to the party's historical home in the Northeast and the upper Midwest. But still, there are a lot of dissenters who think this plan just would not work. Says Nick Gray, the GOP chairman from Missouri, for instance, "I think Ford's got a better chance of carrying Georgia than Massachusetts." In any case, Mr. Ford can be expected to hammer away at the Democratic Congress. The problem seems to be that too much anti-Congress talk could turn out to be a mistake for the GOP, especially for a president who spent 25 years in the House of Representatives and whose opponent never even lived or worked in Washington. Campaign 76. I'm Douglas Edwards, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Mariah McLaughlin, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. When President Ford and presidential candidate Jimmy Carter announced almost simultaneously that they wanted to debate one another during the campaign, the problems began popping up. One of them may have been solved. Presidential debates seem to take more time to arrange than almost any other political happening. And one of the big problems is who foots the bill for them. And this election year, the question was even greater. Under the new federal election law, who can foot the bill for them legally? The League of Women Voters in May had proposed sponsoring the first presidential debate since John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon went at it in 1960. The Federal Election Commission took a quick look at the League of Women Voters and said the organization was an appropriate nonpartisan one to sponsor the debates. But the commission said there were problems. This year, there can be no private contributions to the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates after their nominating conventions are over. From that moment on, the two major party candidates are financed by public subsidies, our tax dollars, to the tune of $21 million each. An additional amount of about 15% can come from the two national committees. So what faced the commission? Would the $150,000 the League of Women Voters said it would cost to put on the debates be a campaign contribution to the two presidential candidates and therefore illegal? The commission decided that the League or any other comparable nonpartisan organization could sponsor presidential debates without running afoul of the federal election law. The Federal Election Commission further said that a separate political fund established by a corporation or labor organization could make unlimited contributions to the league's voter education fund to help pay for the debates, and that any individual could do the same thing. But it said corporations and unions could not dip right into their own treasuries and contribute. So that would appear to solve the money problem of the presidential debates. But there could be court challenges from candidates Eugene McCarthy and Lester Maddox. Both have already said they will take action to prevent debates limited to Ford and Carter. Campaign 76, I'm Mariah McLaughlin, CBS News.
Campaign 76, I'm Sylvia Chase, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Candidate Jimmy Carter was in Washington today, taking care of some delicate business. A report on his quest for the Catholic vote. Democratic presidential candidate Jimmy Carter announced an important endorsement today. Senator Ted Kennedy said he would start campaigning for Mr. Carter in 2 weeks. Maybe he can help with the Catholic vote, a block which so far eludes the Carter lure. The candidate met with Catholic hierarchy today in Washington, but he seems to have made no gains, as we hear from the Carter campaign correspondent, Ed Rabel.
There are 40 million Catholics in this country, and one of the big problems he has is with Catholic voters who are suspicious of him and Catholic clergy who are suspicious of him because of his fundamentalist Baptist, Southern Baptist beliefs, and also because he is unwilling to support a constitutional amendment banning abortion. Today, Carter met in Washington with Catholic clergy, archbishops, and cardinals in the Catholic Church who wanted to discuss with him extensively this question of abortion.
When you think about that, you know, that's sort of like the bashful boy from the South meeting with these men in the peaked hats. That's the image that I have.
Carter appears unsophisticated. His Southern accent would lead one to believe that he isn't sophisticated, but his use of the English language and his knowledge of subjects, including the question of abortion, including the questions on the minds of many of the ethnics and the religious leaders, would just almost immediately give you a clue that the man is certainly not unsophisticated, that he is very well read, that he is articulate. He is able to deal with these problems. Carter did not emerge with the bishops. His press secretary came out before Carter came out, said that Carter would have no statement. Then the bishops came out, and they reiterated their position favoring a constitutional amendment, banning abortion, and saying that they were disappointed with Carter with Carter's position on that question, because he continues his position, which is that he would not support such an amendment. And the polls indicate that there is a certain softness among Catholics as far as support for Carter is concerned, and he's going to have to work on it.
Correspondent Ed Rabel reporting on Governor Jimmy Carter's meeting today with Catholic leaders. Campaign 76. I'm Sylvia Chase, CBS News.